Chapter 17. Of the once majestic iceberg canted first to one side, and then to the other, and then plunged under forever, carrying the National Archives along with it, and not only the archives and the populace, but some eligible town lots which had increased in value as fast as they diminished in size in the tropics, and which Riley could have sold at 30 cents a pound, and made himself rich, if he could have kept the province afloat 10 hours longer, and got her into port. Riley is very methodical, untiringly accommodating, never forgets anything that is to be attended to, is a good son, a stanch friend, and a permanent reliable enemy. He will put himself to any amount of trouble to oblige a body, and therefore always has his hands full of things to be done for the helpless and the shiftless. And he knows how to do nearly everything too. He is a man whose native benevolence is a wellspring that never goes dry. He stands always ready to help whoever needs help, as far as he is able, and not simply with his money, for that is a cheap and common charity, but with hand and brain, and fatigue of limb and sacrifice of time. This sort of man is rare. Riley has a ready wit, a quickness and aptness at selecting and applying quotations, and a countenance that is as solemn and as blank as the backside of a tombstone when he is delivering a particularly exasperating joke. One night a Negro woman was burned to death in a house next door to us, and Riley said that our landlady would be oppressively emotional at breakfast, because she generally made use of such opportunities as offered, being of a morbidly sentimental turn, and so we should find it best to let her talk along, and say nothing back. It was the only way to keep her tares out of the gravy. Riley said there never was a funeral in the neighborhood, but that the gravy was watery for a week. And, sure enough, at breakfast the landlady was down in the very sloughs of woe, entirely broken-hearted. Everything she looked at reminded her of that poor old Negro woman, and so the buckwheat cakes made her sob, the coffee forced a groan, and when the beefsteak came on she fetched a wail that made our hair rise. Then she got to talking about deceased, and kept up a steady drizzle till both of us were soaked through and through. Presently she took a fresh breath and said, with a world of sobs, "Ah, to think of it, only to think of it. The poor old faithful creature." For she was so faithful. Would you believe it, as he had been a servant in that self-same house, and that self-same family for 27 years come Christmas, and never a cross word, and never a lick. And, oh, to think she should meet such a death at last. A-sitting over the red-hot stove at 3 o'clock in the morning, and went to sleep and fell on it, and was actually roasted. Not just frizzled up a bit, but literally roasted to a crisp. Poor faithful creature, how she was cooked. I am but a poor woman, but even if I have to scrimp to do it, I will put up a tombstone over that lone sufferer's grave, and Mr. Riley, if you would have the goodness to think up a little epitaph to put on it which would sort of describe the awful way in which he met her, put it, 'Well done, good and faithful servant,' said Riley, and never smiled. A fine old man, John Wagner, the oldest man in Buffalo, 104 years old, recently walked a mile and a half in 2 weeks. He is as cheerful and bright as any of these other old men that charge around so persistently and tiresomely in the newspapers, and in every way is remarkable. Last November he walked 5 blocks in a rainstorm, without any shelter but an umbrella, and cast his vote for Grant, remarking that he had voted for 47 presidents, which was a lie. His eken crop of rich brown hair arrived from New York yesterday, and he has a new set of teeth coming from Philadelphia. He is to be married next week to a girl 102 years old, who still takes in washing. They have been engaged 80 years, but their parents persistently refused their consent until 3 days ago. John Wagner is 2 years older than the Rhode Island veteran, and yet has never tasted a drop of liquor in his life unless you count whiskey. Science v. S.S. Luck, written about 1867. At that time, in Kentucky, said the Hon. Mr. K., semicolon, the law was very strict against what is termed games of chance. About a dozen of the boys were detected playing even upper LD sledge for money, and the grand jury found a true bill against them. Jim Sturgis was retained to defend them when the case came up, of course. The more he studied over the matter and looked into the evidence, the plainer it was that he must lose a case at last. There was no getting around that painful fact. Those boys had certainly been betting money on a game of chance. Even public sympathy was roused in behalf of Sturgis. People said it was a pity to see him mar his successful career with a big prominent case like this, which must go against him. But after several restless nights, an inspired idea flashed upon Sturgis, and he sprang out of bed delighted. He thought he saw his way through. The next day he whispered around a little among his clients and a few friends, and then when the case came up in court he acknowledged the 7-up and the betting, and, as his sole defense, had the astounding effrontery to put in the plea that old sledge was not a game of chance. There was the broadest sort of a smile all over the faces of that sophisticated audience. The judge smiled with the rest. But Sturgis maintained a countenance whose earnestness was even severe. The opposite counsel tried to ridicule him out of his position, and did not succeed. The judge jested in a ponderous judicial way about the thing, but did not move him. The matter was becoming grave. The judge lost a little of his patience, and said the joke had gone far enough. Jim Sturgis said he knew of no joke in the matter. His clients could not be punished for indulging in what some people chose to consider a game of chance until it was proven that it was a game of chance. Judge and counsel said that would be an easy matter, and forthwith called Deacons Job, Peters, Burke, and Johnson, and Dominies Word and Miggles, to testify, and they unanimously, and with strong feeling, put down the legal quibble of Sturgis by pronouncing that old sledge was a game of chance. What do you call it now? Said the judge. I call it a game of science, retorted Sturgis, and I'll prove it too. They saw his little game. He brought in a cloud of witnesses, and produced an overwhelming mass of testimony, to show that old sledge was not a game of chance, but a game of science. Instead of being the simplest case in the world, it had somehow turned out to be an excessively knotty one. The judge scratched his head over it a while, and said there was no way of coming to a determination, because just as many men could be brought into court who would testify on one side as could be found to testify on the other. But he said he was willing to do the fair thing by all parties, and would act upon any suggestion Mr. Sturgis would make for the solution of the difficulty. Mr. Sturgis was on his feet in a second. Impanel a jury of 6 of each, luck versus science. Give them candles and a couple of decks of cards. Send them into the jury room, and just abide by the result. There was no disputing the fairness of the proposition. The 4 deacons and the 2 dominies were sworn in as the Hans jurymen, and 6 inveterate old 7-up professors were chosen to represent the science side of the issue. They retired to the jury room. In about 2 hours, Deacon Peters sent into court to borrow $3 from a friend. Sensation. In about 2 hours more, Dominie Miggles sent into court to borrow a take from a friend. Sensation. During the next 3 or 4 hours, the other Dominie and the other Deacon sent into court for small loans. And still the packed audience waited, for it was a prodigious occasion in Bull's Corners, and one in which every father of a family was necessarily interested. The rest of the story can be told briefly. About daylight the jury came in, and Deacon Job, the foreman, read the following. Verdict. We, the jury in the case of the Commonwealth of Kentucky versus John Wheeler et al., have carefully considered the points of the case, and tested the merits of the several theories advanced, and do hereby unanimously decide that the game commonly known as Old Sledge or 7-Up is eminently a game of science, and not of chance. a demonstration whereof it is hereby and herein stated, iterated, reiterated, set forth, and made manifest that, during the entire night, the handsmen never won a game, or turned a jack, although both feats were common, and frequent to the opposition. And furthermore, in support of this our verdict, we call attention to the significant fact that the handsmen are all busted, and the science men have got the money. It is the deliberate opinion of this jury that the hands theory concerning 7-up is a pernicious doctrine, and calculated to inflict untold suffering and pecuniary loss upon any community that takes stock in it. That is the way that 7-Up came to be set apart and particularized in the statute books of Kentucky as being a game, not of chance but of science, and therefore not punishable under the law, said Mr. K. Dash. That verdict is of record and holds good to this day. The late Benjamin Franklin, written about 1870. Ever put off till tomorrow what you can do day after tomorrow just as well. B. F. This party was one of those persons whom they call philosophers. He was twins, being born simultaneously in two different houses in the city of Boston. These houses remain unto this day, and have signs upon them worded in accordance with the facts. The signs are considered well enough to have, though not necessary, because the inhabitants point out the two birthplaces to the stranger anyhow, and sometimes as often as several times in the same day. The subject of this memoir was of a vicious disposition, and early prostituted his talents to the invention of maxims and aphorisms calculated to inflict suffering upon the rising generation of all subsequent ages. His simplest acts, also, were contrived with a view to their being held up for the emulation of boys forever, boys who might otherwise have been happy. It was in this spirit that he became the son of a soap boiler, and probably for no other reason than that the efforts of all future boys who tried to be anything might be looked upon with suspicion, unless they were the sons of soap boilers. With a malevolence which is without parallel in history, he would work all day, and then sit up nights, and let on to be studying algebra by the light of a smoldering fire, so that all other boys might have to do that also, or else have Benjamin Franklin thrown up to them. Not satisfied with these proceedings, he had a fashion of living wholly on bread and water, and studying astronomy at mealtime, a thing which has brought affliction to millions of boys since, whose fathers had read Franklin's pernicious biography. His maxims were full of animosity toward boys. Nowadays a boy cannot follow out a single natural instinct without tumbling over some of those everlasting aphorisms and hearing from Franklin, on the spot. If he buys 2 cents worth of peanuts, his father says, "Remember what Franklin has said, my son, a groat a day's a penny a year, and the comfort is all gone out of those peanuts." If he wants to spin his top, when he has done work, his father quotes, "Procrastination is the thief of time." If he does a virtuous action, he never gets anything for it, because virtue is its own reward. And that boy is hounded to death, and robbed of his natural rest, because Franklin said once, in one of his inspired flights of malignity, "Early to bed, and early to rise makes a man healthy and wealthy and wise." As if it were any object to a boy, to be healthy and wealthy and wise on such terms. The sorrow that that maxim has cost me, through my parents, experimenting on me with it, tongue cannot tell. The legitimate result is my present state of general debility, indigence, and mental aberration. My parents used to have me up before 9 o'clock in the morning sometimes, when I was a boy. If they had let me take my natural rest, where would I have been now? Keeping store, no doubt, and respected by all. And what an adroit old adventurer the subject of this memoir was. In order to get a chance to fly his kite on Sunday, he used to hang a key on the string, and let on to be fishing for lightning. And a guileless public would go home chirping about the Istam, and the Aeneas of the hoary Sabbath breaker. If anybody caught him playing umblipig by himself, After the age of 60, he would immediately appear to be ciphering out how the grass grew as if it was any of his business. My grandfather knew him well, and he says Franklin was always fixed, always ready. If a body, during his old age, happened on him unexpectedly, when he was catching flies, or making mud pies, or sliding on a cellar door, he would immediately look wise, and rip out a maxim, and walk off with his nose in the air, and his cap turned wrong side before, trying to appear absent-minded and eccentric. He was a hard lot. He invented a stove that would smoke your head off in 4 hours by the clock. One can see the almost devilish satisfaction he took in it by his giving it his name. He was always proud of telling how he entered Philadelphia for the first time, with nothing in the world but 2 shillings in his pocket and 4 rolls of bread under his arm. But really, when you come to examine it critically, it was nothing. Anybody could have done it. To the subject of this memoir belongs the honor of recommending the army to go back to bows and arrows in place of bayonets and muskets. He observed, with his customary force, that the bayonet was very well under some circumstances, but that he doubted whether it could be used with accuracy at a long range. Benjamin Franklin did a great many notable things for his country, and made a young name to be honored in many lands as the mother of such a son. It is not the idea of this memoir to ignore that, or cover it up. No, the simple idea of it is to snub those pretentious maxims of his, which he worked up with a great show of originality out of truisms that had become wearisome platitudes as early as the dispersion from Babel, and also to snub his stove, and his military inspirations, his unseemly endeavor to make himself conspicuous when he entered Philadelphia, and his flying his kite and fooling away his time in all sorts of such ways, when he ought to have been foraging for soap fat, or constructing candles. I merely desired to do away with somewhat of the prevalent calamitous idea among heads of families that Franklin acquired his great genius by working for nothing, studying by moonlight, and getting up in the night instead of waiting till morning like a Christian, and that this program, rigidly inflicted, will make a Franklin of every father's fool. It is time these gentlemen were finding out that these execrable eccentricities of instinct and conduct are only the evidences of genius, not the creators of it. I wish I had been the father of my parents long enough to make them comprehend this truth, and thus prepare them to let their son have an easier time of it. When I was a child I had to boil soap, notwithstanding my father was wealthy, and I had to get up early, and study geometry at breakfast, and peddle my own poetry, and do everything just as Franklin did, in the solemn hope that I would be a Franklin someday. And here I am. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.